ॐ ज्ञानतिमरं दस्य गणं जना शवाकय चक्षुर्मुतं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरुवे नमः. श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपा कदा मायं ददाति सपदन्तिकम् वंशकौपातुरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभयैव च पतितानं पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. श्रीकृष्णचैतन्यप्रभो नित्यानन्द श्रियाद्वैता गदाधर श्रीवासदे गौरभक्तवृन्द. हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे. So what do we say it is? It's Pramaya, Veda Veda Tattva. Remember there's Pramana. What is Pramaya, what is to be known, and Pramana, what is the evidence for it? So the evidence is the Vedas, specifically the Bhagavatam. And the Pramaya, what is to be known, are the various subjects. As you remember, we're following the story of Vrajanath, one of the persons coming to Krishna consciousness. And remember, he had some resistance from his family. They wanted to get him married, and he felt he had the propensity for renunciation. And we always resist when we're in devotional service. We don't resist getting married, but we do resist whether it's a renunciate or a married person. We resist situations that are not favorable for our Krishna consciousness. To be situated socially properly is important. We see sometimes that people are monks, but they should be married. And it's a disturbance for them, and it's a disturbance for others. And then sometimes there's pressure on someone who should be a monk to get married, and that's a disturbance. So that was the situation of where a person has that propensity. So that's the situation of Vrajanath, and his family was opposed, even some of them. His cousin Vaini Madhava, who is violently opposed, he recently died. So Vrajanath, for some time he couldn't visit. Now he's visiting again his guru Babaji Maharaj. And he's continuing to ask basic questions on the tattva, or the science of Krishna consciousness, which is being answered by Babaji Maharaj by the Dashamula. I'm not sure the origin of it or whether Bhaktivinoda Thakur composed it for the for the novel Jiva Dharma, but it's mula means root. There's 10 root instructions which cover the three basic categories of any philosophical system, which is sambandha, again, metaphysics and epistemology. Metaphysics meaning your description of reality, and epistemology, your evidence that that's true, and then avideya tattva, what's the means of realizing reality, and piyojana, the goal, what's the experience of doing. So I explained this many times. So Dashamula describes that in 8 shlokas. Somebody began to describe that Aistoka is a Bideya Tattva of Bhakti, and the 10th sloka is Prayojana. And actually, after we finish this 8th sloka, it'll be Abhideya, but there's so many subjects that are discussed in that, like with Nam Tattva and the practices of devotional service. That will be an interesting section. So, Vrajanath had heard a little bit about in the spiritual world and your perfection. Either you could be situated in Gaur Lila or Krishna Lila or both, somehow mystically. So he asked, what is the name of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pure teachings? And because each school, each philosophy has to have a teaching of what's God's relationship to this material world. And he also asks, are we Madhva? Is it Madhva is Dvaitavad? Babaji Maharaj discusses the 8th sloka. He said, you should hear the 8th sloka, which describes this Achintya Beta Beta Tattva, and I'll just read that. The entire spiritual and material creation is a manifestation of Sri Krishna's Shakti. The impersonal philosophy illusion, Dvaitavad, is false. It is an impurity that has been produced by Kali Yuga and is contrary to the teachings of the Vedas. Vedas support Achintya Beta Beta Tattva, inconceivable oneness and difference, as the pure and absolute doctrine, and one can attain perfect love for the eternal absolute when he accepts this principle. And then Babaji Maharaj goes on to explain that how Vedanta Sutra is the essence of the Vedas. And different acharyas extract different philosophies. In other words, from the Vedanta Sutra, you have to establish your philosophy. And how Shankaracharya, he explains, has established this Dvaitavad, and that the Parinamvad is false. Now, Dvaitavad means that if there's any transformation in Brahman, it must be illusion. So, this Brahman must be unchangeable to be eternal. So if somehow or other there's any transformation in Brahman, it must be an illusion. So therefore, God is an illusion, the living entities are illusion, and perfection is to realize that there's absolutely no distinction. And Parinamvad, I'm going over this again, Parinamvad means that there's a transfer, that God has energies, and he doesn't change. He doesn't change despite his energies. And later on, the example is going to be given by a touchstone. A touchstone turns everything to gold, but never changes. So, and that's the philosophy of Achintya Beta Beta Tattva, that God has energies, and those energies can transform without God being transformed. And that was the example given of the touchstone. Then he goes on to explain most of the schools are although Shankaracharya, he collected some mantras to support his doctrine. And it's going to be described how actually he completely misunderstood their meaning. But most of the acharyas, they have basic principle of bhakti, and just a little different twist on the relationship between God and this material world. he says the doctrine of Parinamvad is Tat Shakti Parinamvad. What transforms, Parinam means transformation. The transformation is in the Shakti, not God. Whereas Mayavad, or impersonal philosophy, is Parinamvad, and that Brahman transforms, and therefore that transformation must be an illusion. And then, you know, Babaji Maharaj points out how this philosophy is very, very contradictory, because if you have if everything is Maya and there's illusion, then there's still is not undifferentiated oneness. There's God and illusion. And we went over this before. This is, I remember, I gave a class called Defeating Mayavadi Philosophy. And one of the best arguments for is if they talk that the world, you know, that there's illusion, then what is the basis of illusion? And if you say that the living entity is an illusion, you can't say that because the living entity is an illusion. So the living entity can't be the support of illusion, so then you have to say Brahman is the support of illusion. And if you say Brahman is the support of illusion, then it's not Brahman, because Brahman means the greatest. And then you also have the duality that you have Brahman and illusion. So the philosophy, he points out, is contradictory. And the only sensible philosophy is the tat-tat-shakti paramat, that the energies of God transform by his inconceivable potency, which is quite a reasonable conception to understand that God has inconceivable potency. I might not want to tell the story again, but Narada and the cobbler. And when Narada Muni came back to the cobbler and told him that God was setting an elephant through the eye of a needle, he didn't blink. And he just pointed to the banyan tree, which comes from one little seed. And from one little seed, a whole forest can come. So even in this world, we see the inconceivable potency of God. And then what about Brahman being desireless? And he says, no, Brahman has desire, but that doesn't transform God, because that's part of God's own energy, where our desires, they're influenced from external, and they change us. But the independent desire of Brahman is part of its intrinsic nature. So anyway, he made these distinctions, and now we'll read further. Should not be understood that this untransformed supreme is nirvishesh, formless and impersonal. So the Parinamvad, which is the philosophy we accept that God's energies are transforming and that God is not transformed, it doesn't come to the conclusion that he's nirvishesh, that he's formless, or impersonal, or without qualities. Just because you say he's changeless, it doesn't mean he doesn't have qualities. But those qualities are part of his intrinsic nature. And it makes perfect, reasonable sense. On the contrary, this supreme is great and all-encompassing substance, Brahma. He's eternally Bhagavan, the master of six opulence. If one accepts him as merely nirvishesh, one cannot explain his shakti, his spiritual shakti. Why, as a chintya shakti, he exists simultaneously in both personal and impersonal forms. To suppose that he is only nirvishesh is to accept only half the truth without full understanding. His relationship with the material world. Okay, anyway, so he exists. It's not a contradiction. He's Advayam Gyan, he's consciousness, which is non-dual, is nothing different from God. But that doesn't mean there's no differences within God. In fact, Jiva Goswami explains that there is Advayam Gyan, non-dual consciousness. Even with things that are different from God, there's things like when he expands in his personal form, so there's things that are non-different than God, but even the things that are different from God are non-different than God because they're all part of his energy. Nothing is outside the body of God. Now this becomes a little technical and we'll try to follow it for a few minutes. His relationship with the material world is described in the Vedas using the instrumental karana cause, the significant by which, the ablative case, not cause, case, to signify from which, and the locative in which. So God is, it's going to be explained, he's from which, by which, and in which everything happens. And then he quotes from the Taittiriya Upanishads 3:1:1, Yatova imani bhutani jayanti, yena jitani jivanti, yat priyan yabisham vishanti, tad digas satsa tad brahma. One should know that Brahma is he from whom all living beings are born, by whose power they remain alive, and into whom they enter at the end. He is the one about whom you should inquire. He is Brahman. So he is one from whom everything is coming. That's the instrumental case. By whose power they remain alive. That's the ablative case. And into whom they enter at the end. So basically, where they're coming, by which they are living, from which they end. So, I think that's also in the Chatur Shloki Bhagavatam. That God exists before creation, within creation, and after creation. In this shloka, Yatova imani, the ablative case that Ishwar is used, when it is said that living beings are manifest from him, yena, which is the instrumental case, is used when all entities live by his power, and yat, which indicates the locative case, is when it is said that all living beings enter into him. So from which everything is coming, by which everything is leaving, and in which everything ends. These three symptoms show that the absolute truth is supreme. This is his unique feature. That is why Bhagavan is always savishesha, possessing form, qualities, and pastimes. Śrīla Jīva Goswami describes the supreme person in these words. Ekam eva paratattvam svabhavi kanchintya sakti. This is Jiva Goswami. The absolute truth is one. His unique characteristic is that he is endowed with inconceivable potency through which he is always manifested in four ways. So now he's going to describe his savishesh. He's possessing form, qualities, etc. And therefore, by that potency, manifests in four ways. Swarup, as his original form. Tatrupa Vaibhav, as his personal splendor, including his abode and his internal associates, expansions, and avatars. Jivas, as the individual living spirit souls. And Pradhan, as the material energy. So the four aspects of God, his own form, the forms that are expanding from him, the internal potency, the jivas, individual souls, and pradhan. These four features are likened to the interior of the sun planet the surface of the sun rays emanating from this surface, and remotely situated reflection, respectively. These examples only partially explain the absolute truth. So this is a general outline. Swarup, his original form. Tadrupa Vaibhav, the things that come from him. Jivas, the individual spirit souls. And Pradhan, material energy. These four features are likened to the interior of the sun planet, the surface of the sun rays emanating from this surface, and remotely situated reflection, respectively. These examples only partially explain the absolute truth. His original form is Satchitananda, full of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. And his spiritual name, abode, associates in the entire paraphernalia, his direct surfaces, service, or opulence that are non-different for him. Swarup Vaibhav. The countless Nitya Mukta and Nitya Bhada Jivas are dependent, conscious atoms. Anuchit Pradhan includes Maya Pradhan and its products of the entire gross and subtle material worlds. These features exist eternally and similarly, the oneness of the Supreme Absolute is also eternal. Anyway, so it's explaining that these four things are partial expansion, and they expand into many more different categories. But these four features exist eternally, and the oneness of the Supreme Absolute is also eternal. So now he says, how can these two eternal contradictions exist together? That there's eternal oneness and there's eternal difference. How can they exist together? And his answer is that it seems impossible for the limited intelligence of the jiva, the answer. And is only possible through Bhagavan's inconceivable energy. Yet God is not limited to the laws of nature, because he's the creator of the laws of nature. So that's what it means, inconceivable potency. We can't perceive the power of God through the limits of his own material nature. He's not limited by that. So he's beyond time, we cannot conceive that. He's beyond space, we cannot conceive that. Just going to throw in something beyond, you know. I gave another lecture in Washington, Could God Be Blue? And I was giving arguments for God's existence. And I thought of one, which I thought is very powerful. If you speak to an atheist, you can ask him, because they see everything comes from nothingness. So then before the creation, did right and wrong exist? Did right and wrong exist before the creation? And they'd have to say no, because before the creation there was nothingness. If they say no, then right and wrong are relative, and morality is relative, and no one accepts that. Then morality is a relative phenomenon. And no one accepts that morality is a relative. No one will accept that. Like if someone stomps on a child's head, do you think that's relative? Is there any time? Or is it a limited function? No, we do believe that there are moral laws that are eternally existing, that are transcendent to the material world. So I thought that was a very, very strong argument.
Maharaj, is it possible on this point?
It? Yeah.
This is Manchu.
Yeah, Manchu, yes.
I was just going to say, I feel the opposite. I mean, most people that I meet are arguing that there is no absolute standard of morality. There was even a famous TV, you know, the famous atheist, the one who wrote The Selfish Gene. He said he was basically saying that rape is essentially part of like our the interaction him on this point. He said, "Would you be okay with rape?" And he said, "Well, you know, my evolutionary morality doesn't say that that's okay. Hey, but I, you know, basically he was saying like it's kind of biological. Like there's that's kind of how things work, you know. And not most people, when I meet even on stuff,
but let them embrace that." And by the way, not all atheists, you know, that's why the existentialists are appreciated even by the theists, because they embrace their philosophy. I have some notes on that I just discussed. So I just want to just see that for a second. Just one second, because I really want to get this out. This is good.
Yeah, and sorry for bringing it up. It's just a point that I've never heard before.
I think it's a fantastic point. I'm just trying to find out why. Oh, it must be in my bag. Oh, yeah. One second. Now, I really wanted to... I'd like to discuss this point, because it's... Yeah, I got some notes on this that I think will be very, very interesting. Yeah, I forgot these quotes. I'm just going to get it. Now, this is utterly inconsistent. It is inconsistent to say that life is objectively absurd and then to say that one may create meaning for his life. Okay, Camus has been rightly criticized for inconsistently holding both to the absurdity of life and to the ethics of human love and brotherhood, the two are logically incompatible. Moral obligation is a belief that some things ought not to be done regardless of how a person feels about them within herself, regardless of what the rest of her community and culture says, regardless of whether it is in her self-interest or not. Here's this thing. People who laugh at the claim that there is a transcendent moral order do not think that racial genocide is just impractical or self-defeating, but that it is wrong. It's a contradiction. This is the evolutionary theory of moral obligations, sociobiology. This view holds that altruistic people, those who act unselfishly and cooperatively, survive in greater numbers. The point is if they do accept that is no absolute, they don't accept it. You can point to them and say, if there's a child in this room, right, and someone mercilessly stomps on their head, is it wrong? Do you believe it's circumstantially wrong, evolutionary wrong, or it's just wrong? And if they say it's evolutionary, then it's no longer absolute morality. But they don't believe that. They believe it's absolutely wrong, beyond evolution and circumstance. So if people take that view, I think you just have to let them embrace that view. And I don't think people can embrace it. Even C.S. Lewis, the way he became... The way C.S. Lewis became a theist is he was questioning the very tough argument that can evil exist if there's, you know, how can evil exist? How do you reconcile the existence of evil with God? And the fact, he said, that he's making a judgment that something is evil just convinced him there must be a transcendent God. That there must be something. If we actually are making that judgment, there must be something transcendent to just the movement of molecules randomly, which is deterministic, because what's ever happening now is not a volition of our own by evolutionary biology. It's just kind of a domino theory, you know, I forgot what you call it. It's all contingent on something else. We're not in control. We don't have free will. it's hard to even posit free will. If you have, I forgot what that called. Is it called strong rationalism or materialism, we can call it, if your philosophy is materialism? Does that make sense? Are you still on?
Yes, Maharaj. Yes. Yeah. It just took a second to unmute the phone, but that makes sense, Maharaj.
Yeah, they just have to embrace their conclusion.
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to read a little bit more. So what is Vivartavad, Vajanath, Babaji? There is some reference to Vivarta in the Vedas, but it is not Vivartavad. Sri Shankaracharya has interpreted the word Vivarta in such a way that the Vivartavad has come to mean the same as Mayavad. The scientific meaning of the word Vivart is Tatvato Nyata Budhir Vivartam Iyudharata. Vivarta is the illusion of mistaking one thing for another. So what he's saying is the Vivartavad philosophy of the Mayavad is that there, Vivarta is in the Vedas, that things are illusion. But what's illusion is that is not that nothing exists, but the illusion is that things exist, but you mistake one thing for another. So he says, for example, the jiva is an atomic spiritual substance. But when he is bewildered, he imagines that the subtle and gross bodies in which he is engaged are his self. This illusion is ignorance born of a lack of knowledge. And it's the only example of Vivarta found in the Vedas. Sometimes I think I'm a Brahmin, Brahmanat Pandi, the son of the Brahmin Sanatan Pandi. Another may think I am the Sweepa Madhuha, son of the Sweepa Harkuha. But really, such thoughts are completely illusory. The jiva is an atomic spirit spark, and neither Ramanat Pande nor the Sweepa Madhuha. It only seems to be so because he identifies with the body. So the body exists, and the soul exists, but the body as our identity is an illusion. That is superimposed. That is something that's just in the mind. That's not is actually something that's actually there. The illusions of mistaking a rope for a snake and seeing silver in the reflection of a conch shell are similar examples. So a rope exists and a snake exists, and you see the rope as a snake. So you superimpose something that doesn't exist. That is Vivarta. Not that a rope doesn't exist and not that a snake doesn't exist. The Vedas use various examples to try to convince the jivas to become free from this Vivarta, the illusion of identifying oneself with this Mayaka body. Maya bodies reject the true conclusions of the Vedas and establish a rather common theory of Vivartavad. They say that I am Brahman is essential understanding, and the idea that I am a jiva is Vivarta, erroneous understanding. The Vedic examples of Vivarta do not contradict Shakti Parinamvad at all, but the theory of Vivartavad that the Mayavadis put forth is simply foolish. So the examples of Vivarta do not contradict that there's energy. You just mistake one thing for another. Not that there's no energy. That's Mayavadi philosophy. The Mayavadis propose various types of Vivartavad, with three are most common. The soul is really Brahman, but he's become bewildered into thinking himself to be an individual soul. So they say that the individual soul just doesn't exist. That's basically their philosophy. We say it exists, but it misidentifies itself with something else. Or they say the jivas are reflections of Brahma, or the jivas and the material world are just a dream of Brahma. But basically, they propose that the jiva doesn't exist. All these varieties of Vivartavad are false and contrary to Vedic evidence. Vajanath, what is this philosophy called Mayavad? I'm unable to understand it. Babaji, listen carefully. Maya Shakti is just a perverted reflection of the spiritual kingdom and is also the control of the material world, which a jiva enters when he is overpowered by ignorance and illusion. Spiritual things have an independent existence and are independently energetic, but Mayavad does not accept it. There is basically, it doesn't accept the energy of God. It feels that it's an illusion. Again, the same point, because Brahman would be transformed. See, but so what here is saying, there is a Shakti, and the jivas identify with it, and the spiritual things have an independent existence from it, but Mayavadis do not accept this. They declare that the individual self is Brahman and only appears to be different from Brahman because of the influence of Maya. This theory states that the jiva only thinks himself to be an individual entity. And the moment of the influence of Maya is removed, he understands that he's Brahman. So they believe that the eternal, the individual soul, they don't believe in the eternal individuality of the soul, because they don't believe that the soul is individual. And that liberation means that you realize that jiva is the concept of individuality is illusion, and therefore you'll realize that you're Brahman. But it's such a foolish theory, because then you have Brahman that's liberated and Brahman that's in ignorance. It's so silly. According to this conception, while under the influence of Maya, the atomic spiritual spark has no independent identity separated from Maya. And therefore, the way of liberation for the jiva is nirvana, merging into Brahman. Mayavadis do not accept the separate existence of the pure individual soul. Furthermore, they state that Bhagavan is subordinate to Maya and has to take shelter of Maya when he needs to come to this world. They say this is because Brahman is impersonal, doesn't have any form, which means that he has to assume a material mayical form in order to manifest himself in this world. His Isha aspect has a material body. The avatars accept material bodies and perform wonderful feats in this material world. In the end, they leave the material body in this world and return to their abode because they think it's an illusion. That's what Mayavad is, the school that God is illusion. That the relationship between matter and God, that is that God is matter and therefore God is illusion, because there is no energy of matter. It's only an illusory conception. Mayavadis show little kindness towards Bhagavan, for they accept some differences between the jiva and the avatars of Ishwara. The distinction they make is that the jiva has to accept a gross body because of his past karma. It just doesn't make sense. If they don't even believe that there's a jiva. They believe it's Brahman, who's an illusion. His karma carries him away even against his wishes, and you can't even talk about it, actually. When you say that everything is undifferentiated oneness, you can't even talk about it. You can't name anything. The Mayavadis say Ishvara's body, designation, name, and qualities are also material. But he accepts them on his own accord. Whenever he desires, he can reject everything and again his pure spirituality. He's not forced to accept the reactions resulting from the activities that he performs. These are the misconceptions of Mayavadi. Then, Vrajanas, is this Mayavadi philosophy found anywhere in the Vedas? No. Mayavad cannot be found anywhere in the Vedas. Mayavad is Buddhism. We read in the Padma Prana. Okay, are there any questions?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj. This is Gail.
Thanks, Gail.
Can I, do I have two questions?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm so excited. Okay, one question is, I just wanted to I thought you had said at one point that those four features of God, you know, his swarup, his sarubha vaibhav, the jivas and the padan. Did you say that those four features of God are only partial expansions?
No, what I said is they're categories that have many more subcategories. They're not a full explanation.
Somebody's chanting.
Who is that chanting?
Okay, my other question is, you said that, you know, with Krishna, the fact that he has desires is his nature, and so, therefore, you know, that does not constitute a change in him, because that's just part of who he is, having desires. So with the jivas, you said our desires...
I'll read you what it says.
Our desires do change us, but what I want to say is that technically, isn't it that our desires don't actually change us who are the soul. Our desires change
I was just reading what it is, what it said. That's why, if I can find it. It says, one may argue desiring is itself a transformation, so how can this transformation occur in desireless Brahman? The answer to this is you are comparing the desire of Brahman to the desire of the jiva and calling it a vikara modification. Now the jiva is an insignificant shakti. Whatever he desires, that desire comes from contact with another shakti. For this reason, the desire of jiva is called vikara. However, the desire of Brahman is not in this category. The independent desire of Brahman is part of its intrinsic nature. It is one with the Shakti of Brahman, at the same time different. Therefore, the desire of Brahman is the Sarup of Brahman, and there is no place for Vikara. When Brahman desires, Shakti becomes active, and only Shakti is transformed. The subtle point is beyond the discriminating power of the Jiva's minute intelligence can only be understood through the testimony of the Vedas. So, it seems that it's not influenced by anything else. It's part of its nature. Where our desires are influenced by something external to us. That's what it means.
Yeah, but,
okay?
You know, I'm still troubled by the fact that even though it says that our desires are due to our coming in contact with something else, that therefore we become changed.
Forget about the change part. Just that it's intrinsic. It means the desire is its own will. It's not forced upon him by anything external to himself. That's what it means.
Okay,
anybody else like to say hello? Okay, that's everything. Hari Bhog. Hare Krishna Govardhan. Okay, I'm going to go now. Lunchikopa Tribhishtha.